From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, in an interview with NPR, President Obama made his case for a broad and balanced plan to cut the deficit. Mr. Obama said any compromise should include new revenues from an overhaul of the tax code, as well as spending cuts. But he had this caveat.
I think what's absolutely true is that core commitments that we make to the most vulnerable have to be maintained. A lot of the spending cuts that we're making should be around areas like defense spending as opposed to food stamps.
And here's what the president said when asked why the deficit negotiations have been so difficult.
I think that there is some politics and, compromising with me among some Republican leaders is bad politics for them. I also think that, in fairness, that the decisions we've got to make right now are tough ones, and nobody likes them.
You can hear more of Michelle Martin's interview with President Obama tomorrow on NPR's Tell Me More and also at NPR.org.
You can escape the heat for a few hours at least by going to the movies. It was just a few months ago that the comic book superhero Thor had a movie, and now his Marvel Entertainment teammate Captain America has one too. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
Captain America, the First Avenger, is not the best of the Marvel Comics movies, but it does have something the others do not. Chris Evans in the title role. The story begins in the early days of World War II. Evans plays Steve Rogers, the classic 98-pound weakling, a young man who keeps trying to enlist, even though the Army keeps turning him down. Once he gets in, even his commanding officer, played by Tommy Lee Jones, has serious doubts.
When he brought a 90-pound asthmatic onto my Army base, I let it slide. I thought, what the hell? Maybe it'd be useful to you, like a gerbil. Look at that. He's making me cry.
Playing both Rogers and the captain brings out an appealing earnestness and humility in Evans, the kind of personality traits not common in the comic book superhero genre. The plan is to turn Rogers into Captain America by injecting him with a dose of super soldier serum, a process that is nothing if not painful.
Shut it down!
Kills the reactor, Mr. Stark! Turn it off! Kill it! Kills the reactor!
No! Don't! I can do this!
But the Americans are not the only people with super soldiers on their minds. The Third Reich, led by a renegade officer played by Hugo Weaving, is also in the market. And that leads to the movie's action scenes. But that action, even with the addition of 3D, can't help but feel routine. There's a pro forma nature to this entire project. It exists not just for its own sake, but also to prepare the movie-going universe for next year's Avengers movie. That's understandable from a business point of view, but the captain is such an unexpectedly humble hero, it's hard not to hope he'll get more screen time of his own.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Gay history is now a requirement in California public schools. A new state law says the contributions of gays and lesbians must be included in social studies instruction. For member station KQED in San Francisco, Anna Tintakalis reports on how teachers will incorporate this new material into their classes.
Even though the first day of school is a long way off, teacher Eleanor Pratt Smith is getting her lesson plans together. She's from a small district near Sacramento, but she and other educators are in San Francisco to learn about how they can address gay and lesbian issues in the classroom.
I think it's important to recognize that people from any background can contribute to history. To affirm that they've made accomplishments is nice, and I think, you know, that helps people who recognize themselves and identify with those groups.
The law adds lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans to a long list of groups that should be represented in social studies classes, such as African Americans or Mexican Americans. Pratt Smith says she's a bit conflicted about how she'll put the law into practice.
I feel like we're labeling if we're saying that this person contributed to history, and by the way, they are such and such. It seems like we're meeting a quota, and that I don't like.
One of the people Pratt Smith can turn to for help is Will Grant. He teaches history at a private school east of San Francisco, the Athenian School. He's led teacher workshops on how to include gay and lesbian history into social studies classes.
People act as if gays and lesbians popped into the historical world in 1969. And when people find out that gays and lesbians have been a part of all cultures going back past recorded history, then that really shifts the way that people think about things.
Grant says this isn't about teaching sex. It's about recognizing sexual identity.
Sex is something that you cover in health class. Sexual identity is this idea of who does your sexuality make you into and how does that affect a person's and a group of people's social position and the way that society looks at them and the way that they look at society. That's what we cover.
Supporters of the new law also believe teaching gay history will help to foster tolerance on campus. UC Berkeley professor Tina Trujillo says a change in instruction can shift students' opinions on a given subject.
We already have state law that mandates that we teach about women, that we teach about Asian Americans, that we teach about various other groups, marginalized and non-marginalized. And the intention of, behind that law is to make sure that students develop a well-rounded understanding in their communities.
This is not tolerant. It's promoting something.
Randy Thomason is with the nonprofit group Save California. He says teaching gay history will simply distract students and teachers.
If you go into a classroom of second graders and say, let me tell you about a man who was really attracted to other men, those kids will squirm, they'll bust up laughing. Why? They're not even sexually developed.
This is really about empowering kids.
Judy Elliott is in charge of curriculum for the Los Angeles Unified School District. She says teaching about influential gay and lesbian leaders sends a message to gay and straight students that they have promising futures. She says teachers should no longer sidestep the issue.
So there'll be lots of opportunities to take a standard and then find an interesting article or an interesting something or other. There are many historians that we study right now that were gay, but nobody talks about them, right?
The new law means California will begin buying new textbooks that include gay and lesbian history once the state budget improves. California is one of the biggest buyers of teaching materials in the U.S. That means these textbooks will most likely be offered to other states as well. For NPR News, I'm Anna Tentakulis in San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A year ago today, jubilant Democratic lawmakers, including then-Senator Christopher Dodd and Congressman Barney Frank, joined President Obama on stage to sign a new financial reform law.
The American people will never again be asked to foot the bill for Wall Street's mistakes. There will be no more tax-funded bailouts, period.
The president said the Dodd-Frank Act would mean no firms are too big to fail. But many financial firms have consolidated and actually have gotten bigger since the crisis. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, it's not clear if the new law really means an end to government-funded bailouts.
This seems like a basic question. Is too big to fail dead? The administration's categorical answer is yes. They say under the new law, the government can oversee the dismantling of a failing firm, but it has no legal authority to do bailouts. But some experts believe the truth is actually a little murkier.
To the question of whether too big to fail is gone or not, the jury's still out.
Sarah Rosen-Wartell is an executive vice president for the Center for American Progress and a former Clinton administration official. She says it's unclear because regulatory agencies are still hammering out details of how to implement the law. Wartell cites the so-called living wills provision as an example. Regulators will require some large financial firms to file living wills or details about how their businesses operate. The theory is that, in the event of another crisis, this will would help the government wind down a failing business without disrupting the financial system.
And the real question is whether the regulators will have enough strength to look at some of those plans and where they see that there's too much systemic risk there, that it's going to be too hard to unwind these institutions, will they force restructurings and divestitures of some of these institutions? Not clear yet. That's one of these places where there's a great deal of discretion left to the regulators.
Wartell says whether the living will works and whether too big to fail ends depends largely on how muscular regulators are. She says opponents are trying to weaken the rules, by delaying implementation or by threatening to cut funding.
But I think we are better off than we were before the legislation, absolutely no doubt, and we have the promise of a more effective system.
Peter Wallison disagrees. Wallison is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He was also a commissioner at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, who has, from the beginning, criticized the financial reform law.
We have, in the Dodd-Frank Act, institutionalized too big to fail.
Wallison says by identifying large firms that need to file living wills, regulators are essentially saying these are the companies that are too big to fail. He says investors will once again take that as a kind of implicit government guarantee.
And those companies will have major advantages over their smaller competitors. This is a serious, serious problem in my view.
Wallison says the large firms may benefit from their unofficial status as being too big to fail, but they will also have to comply with greater regulatory oversight. The effect, he says, is U.S. financial firms will lose ground to foreign competitors. Wallison isn't saying this will lead to another taxpayer-financed bailout, but he doesn't see how it will prevent one either. The Dodd-Frank Act's intent is to give regulators a broader array of tools to monitor the financial system. When the next big shock comes, the government wants to be able to minimize the fallout. The problem is, it might take another crisis to see if the new system works. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
And speaking of cold drinks, it's time now for another Sound of Summer.
It's summertime!
My name is Yolanda Young, and I'm a writer. My summer sound is ice rattling in a tall glass of iced tea. I spent summers at my great-grandmother's house in Louisiana. My mother couldn't afford summer camp or a babysitter, so every Sunday after church, she'd pack my suitcase and drive me across town to Big Mama's house. Big Mama had no air conditioning, and my bedroom was off the kitchen, where Big Mama spent most of her time cooking. Can you say hot? We had no ice maker, so we spent the days emptying the contents of metal ice trays into giant bowls. We never wanted to run out of those cubes. In the mornings, I'd plop them into my milk. All afternoon, I'd crunch on flavored cubes made from frozen Kool-Aid. In the evenings, Big Mama and I would sit on her front porch sipping sweet tea as the ice in our glasses crackled and popped. A precocious child, I was known to mimic things I'd seen on TV. So I'd gotten in the habit of toasting the end of the day. Cheers, I'd say to Big Mama. She'd look at me with a bemused smile and say, "Cheers, baby." We'd tap our glasses in honor of another great summer day.
The latest in our series, Summer Sounds, from writer Yolanda Young. The end of the shuttle program is being felt exceptionally hard at Johnson Space Center in Houston. Thousands of people there worked on the shuttle and related projects, and the center is a major economic force in the city and the region. NPR's Wade Goodwin paid a visit recently, and he found that there's some sadness, but there's also hope for the future.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5... All three engines up and burning. And liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis.
At the Johnson Space Center, as the last shuttle climbed into the sky, it was a sad, wonderful moment.
Houston now controlling the flight of Atlantis.
The engineering, the research and technology development for the space shuttle and the space station all happened at the Johnson Space Center. The space shuttle will soon be a memory of triumph, sacrifice, and underrated achievement. For the astronauts who flew them, the big old space trucks will be remembered with love.
The very first time I looked back at Earth, it took my breath away. And you're just up there floating around, completely free to move wherever you want to. It definitely changes your life.
Astronaut Mike Gernhardt has logged 43 days on the shuttle, including 23 hours and 16 minutes walking in space. You'd think a 55-year-old astronaut would be satisfied with a cold beer on the back porch, telling about that time he had to take 3 spacewalks to install the space station airlock. But no.
So my dream has always been to go to the moon, and I've worked the last 5 years tirelessly to develop the architecture, the operations concepts, this new rover that you might have seen that we actually live in for like 2 weeks at a time, and we get into the suits that are hanging off the back on suit ports. So
the end of the shuttle program has been years in the works. What wasn't expected was the cancellation of the Constellation project by President Obama. Constellation was about building the next generation of rockets and spacecraft. But its cancellation has not thrown Gernhardt for a loop. Now, instead of going to the moon, he's working on landing astronauts on a giant passing asteroid.
I'm not one that goes off and cries in the corner, so I'm not happy about that. And at the same time, me and my team are attacking, working on the asteroid, very novel ways to anchor and translate on an asteroid surface.
If the cancellation of Constellation doesn't have Gernhardt crying in a corner, others are.
Well, I'm very angry, and most of the people here are very angry because this administration still has not come up with a mission.
Bob Mitchell is the president of the Bay Area Houston Economic Partnership, which includes 51 local aerospace companies. Mitchell says that while thousands of engineers and scientists are losing their NASA-related jobs, many are finding new jobs in Houston. The energy sector is extremely healthy, and while not as glamorous as exploring the final frontier, exploring for oil is nevertheless pretty lucrative.
The fortunate part is these are highly educated, well-trained, highly skilled employees that other industries are wanting to keep in this region.
Not having a specific mission to Mars or the moon doesn't mean there's no missions at all. For example, NASA scientist John Olanson heads up the Morpheus Project.
Morpheus Project is a integration of different technologies that we've been pursuing here at Johnson Space Center, liquid oxygen, liquid methane propulsion, as well as autonomous landing and hazard avoidance capability for landing on an extraterrestrial body.
Got that? New escape pods, rovers that will have wheels for the moon or a jet propulsion sled for asteroids. Same rover, different undercarriages for different missions. Don't get astronaut Mike Gernhardt started about the new rover, which he's already testing at White Sands.
I describe it as the combination between a sports car and a spacesuit. It's a very nimble vehicle. It can actually turn 360 in the so-called crab mode. The front of it looks like a helicopter. We've got great windows so we can make
If there's no money right now for a mission to the moon or to Mars, most at NASA understand Washington politicians and their priorities come and go. In the meantime, they're getting ready. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
In space cryopropulsion stage, if we can build those chess pieces that